Well, let's go ahead and get started. I believe we left off at verse 14. Satan, which is referenced here in verse 13 of Revelation chapter 12 as the dragon, Satan is kicked out of heaven just before this, and the heavens in verse 12 rejoice at that fact. But a voice says, "Woe to the inhabitants of the earth," because Satan, who's going to be very ticked off, again, this being futuristic, woe to the inhabitants of the earth because of what he's getting ready to do. Did you guys like that video last week of Petra?
Yes. Yes.
Very interesting.
And so whenever we see here in Revelation chapter 12, them heading to the wilderness, that's one possible location. It's quite possible it's not Petra and it's somewhere that we don't even know. Who knows? But we do know that the reason they're taken care of is because there's a place prepared for them. That's what Revelation tells us here. And that God is going to be the one to take care of the nation of Israel. This is, again, how he woos Israel back to himself. We've talked before, even on Sundays, how people look at God as a judgmental God, as a mean God. How can God, you know, do these things? Even if you're talking about in the Old Testament, how could God, you know, let the people of Israel get taken by Babylon and Assyria and all this kind of stuff? Well, it's because of the actions of Israel. But here in the book of Revelation, whenever they go into the tribulation, and that's what we talked about last week or the week before about Hosea chapter 2, that is God wooing Israel back to himself so that they will look to him as their protector, as their husband, actually. So here in verse 13, Revelation 12, it says, "When the dragon saw that he was cast of the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child," again, the woman being Israel, "and to the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness into her place." It's an interesting phrase there. "Where she is nourished for a time and half a time, from the face of the serpent." We know that we already talked about time and half a time. This is talking about 3.5 years. But notice a couple things here in verse 14. "Into her place." It reminds you a little bit about verse 6 in chapter 12 says. "That, and the woman fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared of God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. So there's a place that's prepared, already prepared by this point, for the people of Israel. It's not just a matter of them willy-nilly going to some location. There's a specific place in mind, and God is going to be that one to provide, bring nourishment. It's interesting to hear this phrase, the two wings of a great eagle. Look at Exodus 19, verse 1. Oftentimes with the book of Revelation, the imagery that's being mentioned is a product of things that have been talked about in the past in the Old Testament.
What verse was it?
Exodus chapter 19, we're going to start in verse 1.
Okay.
But so you have a lot of that imagery is a product of things that were talked about in the Old Testament. So to understand the book of Revelation, you really do need to study the Old Testament. And it's a shame whenever pastors don't want to teach on the Old Testament because it brings so much understanding to the future events. And then people, if you don't understand the book of Revelation, then you're caught up to, you know, those winds of doctrine that are completely false. So here in verse 1, it says, "In the third month, when the children of Israel had gone forth out of the land of Egypt, the same day came they into the wilderness of Sinai." This is a great verse if you watch documentaries on where the actual place of Mount Sinai is, because you have one big clue in this verse right here. That is not only not talking about the third month, but when the children of Israel gone forth out of the land of Egypt, the same day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. So that means in that same day that they left, they were able to get out of Egypt and get into Sinai. So if you listen to many of the incorrect, in my opinion, ideas of where, you know, Mount Sinai is, it has them going down through Egypt and spending all kinds of time, which would have taken them
weeks
to get across. It's how much the Bible can interpret the facts for us. Verse 2 of Exodus 19. For they were departed from Rephidim and were come to the desert of Sinai and had pitched in the wilderness, and there Israel camped before the mount. And Moses went up unto God, and the Lord called out to him out of the mountain, saying, Thus shalt thou say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, You have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bare you on eagle's wings, and brought you unto myself. So here, back in Revelation 12, when we see this phrase in Revelation 12, 14, that should strike a chord with Jews, with the connection to how he delivered them out of the hand of the Pharaoh of Egypt, he's now going to deliver them out of the hand of the Antichrist. Same kind of thing. And again, once again, he's trying to, remember, with what he's doing with coming out of Egypt, then it's not until after that that he makes the covenants with them. Yeah, I mean, you had the nation of Israel, but the covenants or the law, those things, didn't exist when Exodus 19 was taking place. And so here, you're going to see what's going to happen, in my opinion, is the new covenant eventually going to take place. So you see the similarities between Revelation 12, what it's talking about, and Exodus 19. Very, very similar. And obviously, the people of that it's talking about here is the nation of Israel. You know, we're the body of Christ isn't here. So, back to chapter 12, verse 14, it says that she, a woman, were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place where she'll be nourished for a time and times and half a time. You know, basically this place that's prepared for them. Well, turn with me to Isaiah chapter 26. Isaiah chapter 26. See, there, they've been given prophecies concerning. People have asked, well, how are they going to know what they need to do? How are they going to know what they need to do? Well, the Lord has been prophesying what's going to happen and what they need to do for a long, long time. For a very long time. It is Isaiah chapter 26. Look at, now this verse, we're going to look at verse 20. This is one of the verses that would have, I believe, that the guy used in that video last week, talking about Petra. Here in verse 20, it says, Come, my people, enter thou into thy chambers and shut thy doors about thee. Hide thyself, as it were, for a little moment, until the indignation be overpassed. And again, talking about the punishment that's going to come on mankind when God is going to judge the earth. And he's saying, go hide yourself until this gets taken care of. So, back to Revelation 12. So here they're going to go into their place, a specific place, where they're going to be nourished for a time and times. How is he going to nourish them? Well, like I said, we looked at verse 6, that talks about it. And I think we may have even mentioned this before. If you go to 1 Kings, you'll see where God had nourished in the past people, literally having ravens bringing food to people. So it's not impossible whatsoever. How this is going to be done, who knows, but it's certainly going to be done. So. Verse 15. And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that might cause her to be carried away of the flood. And the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood with which the dragon cast out of her mouth. It's interesting here because is this talking about actual water, or is it more symbolism referring to what many suggest, what seems to make the most sense, is that the water here is actually a reference to an army. And the earth is going to open up and swallow that army because they're coming, the army of the Antichrist is coming to chase the woman, and God is going to defend the nation of Israel. So the earth actually intervenes on behalf of God, on behalf of the nation of Israel. And it's not the first time that we've seen this explanation used like that. Go to Jeremiah 46. Look at verse 8. Here are the references to Egypt rising up like a flood. Jeremiah 46:8 says, Egypt rises up like a flood, and his waters are moved like the rivers. And he saith, I will go up, and I will cover the earth. I will destroy the city and the inhabitants thereof. So here you have an example of that situation where an army is referred to in this symbolism of a flood or water and stuff like that. And so many suggest that this isn't actual water proceeding out of somebody's mouth, that the Bible, again, is explaining itself in the sense that the Antichrist, who is chasing the woman because he's mad as can be because he's been kicked out of heaven, and he's chasing the nation of Israel, and he sends his army to conquer them. Literally, the earth opens up in some way, fashion, and we've even seen that before, haven't we? Can you think of an example of whenever the earth has swallowed up people?
Red Sea, when they're complaining with Moses.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm assuming you're talking about whenever they built the calf and all that kind of stuff, and all that. Literally, there were, you know, instances where those who were taking part in that were being slayed and the earth opened up and swallowed people. So, again, is that exactly what's going on? I think that's what the Bible is certainly giving us the image of what's happening here. So, verse 15, again, you have this water come out of the mouth of the Antichrist, you can look at, if you're taking notes.
This is Satan, not the Antichrist.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
Okay.
Good catch.
Okay.
Yes, I'm sorry, good catch.
You said that a while ago, and I was going to ask you, and I thought, well, maybe you just made a mistake, but then you said it the second time, I'm like, uh-oh, maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah. What we also have to remember is Satan's certainly behind this.
Oh, yeah.
But we also know that the Antichrist is his main tool for doing things.
He was the first 3.5 years, the Antichrist.
Well, and he's also part of the next 3.5 too, because he's the one.
Oh, well, how do you get killed?
Well, he will be getting killed shortly, but then he rises up. He's brought back to life. So that's how. That's how they start to worship his image, is because he's brought back to life.
Yeah.
The abomination of desolation and all that kind of stuff. So he will get killed before the end, mm-hmm. before Satan. You know, the Antichrist and the false prophet both get thrown in the lake of fire, mm-hmm. before the thousand-year reign. Satan gets locked in the bottomless pit, mm-hmm. then the thousand-year reign, then the battle, then Satan's thrown in as well. So the Antichrist has still got some time left, and we'll see him prominently here in chapter 13, again in verse 14 or chapter 14. So I guess my point is that this is describing the dragon who's going after Israel, But that doesn't mean that it's not the dragon who's going after him, and the Antichrist is involved in that. Who knows? So. But again, if you want some verses to compare it being an army, we looked at Jeremiah 46:8, but you can look at Isaiah 59:19 if you're taking notes and you want to check that out later. So, verse 16, and the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth. Verse 17, the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. What's interesting is he's trying to get to Israel. Now Israel's hidden safely, tucked away in its prepared place, and he can't get to them. Satan can't get to Israel, so what does he do? Does he say, oh, well, I guess I learned my lesson? No, he goes after the remnant, here's what it says, of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. There are those that, again, they want to suggest that this is 144,000, and I don't take one position or the other because I think that it certainly makes sense that it could be the 144,000. There's nothing I see that would say that it's not. But there's not a whole lot to really nail that position down in any type of affirmative way. The Bible is a bit silent on that. Some commentators make a very good, valid point that when you get to the chapter 14, we're going to immediately be talking about the 144,000 again. So they will suggest that that's proof in itself that that's who this remnant is. Maybe not. I'm not going to teach it that way. But we do know that this is the remnant of her seed, and that they keep the commandments of God. And I don't think that we take that phrase lightly. I think that when this is saying keep the commandments of God, I don't think it's referring to how people today try to keep the commandments of God. I think here they actually do keep the commandments of God. They're actually doing it. They're not making mistakes in the sense that we think of today with even those who want to try to keep the commandments, even they don't have to. These people aren't like the ones, even when the law was in place, who weren't keeping the commandments, the whitewashed sepulchres and stuff like that that Jesus referred to. These are the ones who are keeping the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So that's who Satan's going to go after next, is go after them. It is interesting to wonder, again, who these people are. Because apparently they're not with Israel that just fled into the wilderness. It makes you, to me, wonder, I don't know about you, but it makes me wonder why. If they're the 144,000, it's because they say, well, he can't hurt us, so we'll, we'll just stay here and continue to minister. The Bible doesn't tell us that.
Are they traveling the world ministering?
Well, that's what I mean, yeah. Stay here meaning not going to the wilderness. Yeah. Because you would think that they would have fled unless, again, I can't think of why they wouldn't, except for the fact that they were confident in the fact that they're protected. Which would, again, justify the idea of the 144,000, because if you're somebody who's keeping the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ, I'm assuming you're going to be Jewish, why wouldn't you follow the instructions like everybody else and fled? I mean, I can't think of a good reason why they wouldn't, except for that one. Especially since Christ had already told people, when you see this, go leave. So, makes you wonder if there's not further instruction prophecy or something that's going to take place to these people here in the future. So, all right, chapter 13. Here again, we have the Antichrist. We've got some. Here we're going to get into some of that imagery, that symbolism that I don't get too dogmatic about. But I think that there's justification for some of the positions out there. And so as we go through this again, I just want to remind you, we're going to look at the verses that allow us to let the Bible speak for itself. And because there are some verses that tell us specifically what some of these things are. I mean, like it's going to talk about the seven heads that are going to be on this beast. Well, the Bible tells us in Revelation 17, we're going to look at what those seven heads are. So we know exactly what those are. But we are going to get into some of the parts on here where it's not specific. So, but I do think that there's a pretty good understanding of a decent possibility of what this all this means. So, again, if you don't study the Old Testament, and if you don't study the Gospels, you're going to have a hard time understanding the book of Revelation. It just, there's so much that it's related to, so, which is not a coincidence that those are all written to the nation of Israel. So. Revelation chapter 13, it says, "And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his head the name of blasphemy." Right here we jump right into the complex aspect of what these different things are talking about. Here what we're going to end up seeing, what we're going to, you have to understand that as the 3.5 year mark has come upon us in this study, which is really around chapters 10 through 14, is really about that 3.5 year mark. We've moved from the tribulation period to the great tribulation period. The approach that the Antichrist is taking on and what we're going to end up seeing here is an approach to assume control over all of mankind. And as we study this, keep that in mind, because ultimately what we're seeing here is a description that's also very similar to what Daniel's prophecy talks about. And we'll look at some of those verses that Daniel talks about. And there's four kings that Daniel talks about. And three of those, it's pretty obvious, have already happened. The fourth one, it's most likely, is the Antichrist himself. And so here in chapter 13, what we're going to end up seeing is that the Antichrist, again, is going to, through deception, through the use of promising peace, he's going to be a skilled politician. I'm trying to think of my memory is so bad. Somebody had made a comment recently, and I can't remember what it was, but it was something about a politician and promises. I can't remember what it was. Yeah. Well, and we see today now in the election cycle. Actually, I did. I think I read an article, or I didn't read the article. I read a headline that Joe Biden promised that if he was elected, yeah, he was going to. They were going to cure cancer.
Right.
But I guess it's not going to happen if he doesn't get elected, huh? So, the Antichrist is going to come on the scene, and he is going to be, without naming any of anybody's favorites or most disliked politicians, he is going to be cunning, he's going to be ruthless, he's going to be deceptive, he's going to make promises, he's going to keep promises, and he's also going to break promises. He's going to be I've got one politician in mind, and I'm not going to say his name. But and he's not in office right now, so that's what you were wondering. So was not that long ago, though. Hint, hint. And I'm not saying it's him. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying he's the Antichrist, no. But you can understand he's... Well, no, just, you know, being articulate, being able to talk to people, persuade people, be somebody that's, you know, likable. What's that?
Good salesman.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it. I mean, most of these guys that rule come into power, they're able to persuade in one way, shape, or form, and then comes the destruction. And so this Antichrist is going to be, again, he is going to promise peace. But I don't care whether it's Joseph Stalin. I don't care if it's Adolf Hitler. I don't care who it was. When they come promising peace, and then what ends up following is war and destruction. And it's going to be that to the 10th scale with this guy. He is going to be wrapped up in seeking authority and power. Again, we've seen many a dictators come on the scene over the past 100 and some odd years, and none of them's worked out. They come with all these promises of free things and greatness, and all this stuff is going to be great, which is what set our country, our founding different. It was about liberty. It wasn't a promise that you're going to get something free out of something. It was you're going to have to work hard to keep it, but you're going to have your liberty. This guy, I think, is going to come on the scene with the idea to deceive and to take control. So here it talks about, verse 1, John says he sees, he stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads. And again, these seven heads, the Bible does tell us what those are. Turn to chapter 17 of Revelation. Verses 9 and 10 tell us what these are. Verse 9 says, "And here is the mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains of which the woman sits, and there are seven kings. Five are fallen, and one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space." And so here we know that these seven mountains that's mentioned here in chapter 1, these seven heads are these seven mountains. And these are kingdoms. These are going to be seven kingdoms. Look at Isaiah chapter 2, verse 2. And so here, starting verse 1, the word of that Isaiah the son of Amoz saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem, "And it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow into it." And so we see mountains referred to as kingdoms. Look at Jeremiah 51. Verse 24. Here, Babylon is itself specifically referred to as a mountain. Verse 24. "And I will render unto Babylon and to all the inhabitants of Chaldea all their evil that they have done in Zion in your sight, saith the Lord. Behold, I am against thee, O destroying mountain, saying the Lord, which destroys all the earth. And I will stretch out my hand upon thee and roll thee down from the rocks, and I will make thee a burnt mountain." I'm talking about the destruction of that kingdom. And so here these seven heads are seven mountains, and the mountains are kingdoms. So thus we see here what it appears to be is there's going to be seven kingdoms that are going to form an alliance during this time period. Seven kingdoms with seven different kings are going to form an alliance. There are those who suggest that the Antichrist is one of those. That seems to make the most sense, that he is one of those seven. But I can't say for certain that I've convinced of that. So, all right, so then you go on and you have the seven heads, and it talks about the horns, the ten horns. Ten horns, again, the speculation is that these are ten kings without kingdoms. And so you have seven kings who have kingdoms, and then you have, which are the seven heads, and then you have ten horns, which are kings that don't have a kingdom. And if you read some commentaries that do a good job, they would suggest that these are people maybe like former heads of states who have lots of power, lots of authority. Today we see presidents when they finish their tour of duty, so to speak. What do? They go on speaking tours. They continue to be powerful. They continue to have influence. And so the idea here is that these horns are ten kings without a kingdom. And upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. Again, a perfect description of the Antichrist. I mean, what does Antichrist mean?
Against Christ.
Against Christ. And what is his tactic? It's to imitate Christ to the point that he can be revealed for who he really is. And so he is going to be, in every way that Christ was good, he is going to be bad. He is blasphemy in itself, if you think about it. He's the pure description of blasphemy. So, any questions on that? Comments, thoughts? Verse 2, and the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were the feet of a bear, and his mouth is the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. This Antichrist is going to get his authority, he's going to get his power from Satan himself. He's going to be Satan. Believe it or not, Satan has supernatural powers. To what extent those are, to what extent they're limited, to what extent they're granted, I don't know. But we do know that God granted Satan the authority, the power to some extent to be able to do mass casualties to Job's family. I mean, there were literally, trying to think of the word here that I'm trying to think of is just natural disasters, I guess, is what I could say. He had the power to cause natural disasters to some degree. And so here, at this time, Satan's going to have the power to be able to help convince the world to trust in the Antichrist, which has everything to do with eventually, so because the Antichrist is going to point the finger back towards Satan. So that's really... really what it's going to be about. So here you have this description of these animals. Now it's interesting when you consider this description. It's interesting for a couple of reasons, because Daniel, coincidentally, has a very similar description whenever he's talking about the four kings. He talks... And what we'll get to in a little bit here is that when Daniel describes these attributes, he describes them in the opposite order than John does. What do you think that the reason might be for that? consider this. What point in history is Daniel looking at this from? He's looking at it from here, looking this way. Which way is John looking at it from? He's looking at it and looking backwards in time. So it would make sense. And it's, again, it's a theory. The Bible doesn't say that's why he did it. But it would make sense that John, and this is, again, further proof to me that shows the perfection and how anybody is crazy to suggest that this was conceived in the mind of man. The idea that man could have wrote this is just crazy, in my opinion. And so we're going to end up looking at Daniel in a minute, but let's look at this description again. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leper. Well, how would you describe a leper?
Sneaky.
Matter of fact, the Bible, in a couple of places which we'll look at, describes a leopard as always watching for its prey. Sneaking, swift, fast, stalking is a description. Oftentimes, and for time's sake, if you want to write these down, you can go look at them later, but Jeremiah chapter 5, verse 6, and chapter 13, verse 23, the Bible describes a leopard in this sense. When you think of a bear, what do you think of? Strength and power, brute force. I mean, you know, the door's not going to stop. The door's probably not going to stop a bear that wants to get inside. You know, there's just sheer brute force when it comes to a bear. And when you think of a lion, the king of the beast, it's probably, if you're in the woods, if you're in the jungle, you know, there's probably many, many animals that are going to do you harm. But the one sound that you don't want to hear is the sound of that roaring lion. That's probably going to be the one above all that you don't want to hear. Lions known for not having any care, no mercy. They'll, you know, take over a pride and they'll go slaughter all the young of the previous one and then lay down and go to sleep like it's nothing. You know, you might hear stories of bears doing, you know, lovable things, you know. I don't know the last time I ever heard about a lovable thing being done by a lion. You know, I haven't seen that one on Facebook yet. Lions are known for being the most fearful animal out there. Granted, I'd put a shark up there with it, but a great white, yeah. But that's what a lion's known for. So here you have this description of what the beast, what John attributed to this beast. And he says, the leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him power and his seat and great authority. And I think, actually, you guys have a Scofield Bible, don't you, Tim? Or you guys do? If I remember right, when I was researching this, Scofield defined these as the swiftness of the leopard, the tenacity of the bear, and the voracity of the lion. I don't know if that's in your notes or not, but is that how, do you have any notes there like that? Well, that's my understanding of it, so. So you get the picture as when John sees the beast, when he sees the Antichrist, and he sees what he's like, this is his description. This is the way he's trying to warn the future readers of what they're like. Let's look at some of these passages. Turn to Daniel chapter 7. we'll start in verse 1, I guess. Chapter 7, verse 1. In the first year of Belteshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matters. Daniel spoke and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heaven strove upon the great sea. Sea, oftentimes being a metaphor of the people, the nations, and a populace, that type of thing. And so the idea here is that from the heavens, the Lord is what word would I use here? Influencing even the unbelievers. He's influencing all things. Verse 3, and four great beasts came up from the sea. So if the sea is talking about what?
People.
And so he says, four great beasts came out from the people, diverse one from another. So each there's four different ones, and each one is different than the other in different ways. The first was like a lion. What was the last one in again in John's?
Lion.
A lion. Here the first one is the lion. And the four great beasts came up. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon the feet as a man, and the man's heart was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second like to a bear. And it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs on the mouth between it, the teeth, and devour and rise, devour much flesh. Verse 6, and after this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. Now, before we read the next one, speculation is that each of these beasts that rise up are kings of kingdoms. Any guess on who those would be? I'm sure you could think of some of them. Mm-hmm. Who would these?
Greece
is considered to be the third one.
Persia.
Medo-Persia is often considered to be the second one because they actually joined forces in conquering their foes, which would be a description of that second one, how they rose up from one side. And the first one would be Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon. So you would have Nebuchadnezzar being possibly the first beast. And again, this is speculation. It fits. But if you're into trying to figure out the symbolism here, Babylon would be the first beast, literally being Nebuchadnezzar. The second one would be King Cyrus from Medo-Persia. The third one would actually be Alexander the Great from Greece. And then the fourth one, now here's where you get difference of opinion. First three, most people agree on. It's the last one that people tend to disagree. Some will tell you that was Rome. And that has a couple of problems, and I'm not saying it's not Rome. I'm just saying it does have a couple of problems with it. First, let's read it. Look at verse 7. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly. And it had great iron teeth that devoured and broke in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns. Now again, people who suggest that this is Rome, they have very, good, compelling arguments for it. The reason why I won't say that it is Rome is because there are some compelling reasons why it wouldn't be Rome. One, if it was Rome, then it would almost certainly have to be Rome that takes power in the future. Because this one here is going to end up being a futuristic one, in my opinion. Second of all, when you look at this description, do you notice how this fourth one is described to be strong exceedingly? Almost like this fourth one is the most powerful of the bunch. Now, was Rome actually more powerful than Greece? Well, at the time of Rome it was, but not before then. Greece's empire was vastly bigger than Rome's. It was much bigger than Rome's.
What about Russia or China?
That's why I say, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I think it's a valid argument to say that it is Rome, but then Rome has to somehow still be that fulfillment. I personally think that the fourth one is the Antichrist. I think it's the Antichrist kingdom. That position is what makes the most sense to me, is that the Antichrist kingdom, when it's talking about here, it's his kingdom, which is exceedingly above the rest of them. He's going to be able to accomplish what the other ones couldn't. The other ones wanted complete domination, complete control. The Antichrist is going to get it, apart from the nation of Israel. And we know that because Scripture says that all nations are going to come against Israel, right? So if it's all nations, then the Antichrist does have control. So if this is Rome, then that means there must be a new Rome, and then that lends to problems. Because where's Rome in relation to the Middle East? It's to the west. So if you're looking at the Middle East, Rome is off to the west. If you study Israel's history, from my study of it, almost all the warnings and descriptions of things that are coming to Israel, the problem's always coming from the east.
Yeah, that's why I said China or Russia.
Yeah, yeah. But guess what is to the east of Israel? Babylon. In Revelation, go back to Revelation, look at chapter 18. It seems that Babylon is the heart of the Antichrist empire. And so the idea of Rome, again, I'm not saying it's not Rome. You know, it might be somehow affiliated with Rome in some way. Might be. I don't know. But I do know that the scriptures indicate that the seat of the power is in Babylon. Look at chapter 18. We'll just start in verse 1. And after these things, I saw another angel come down from heaven, having great power, and the earth was lightened with his glory. And he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become the habitation of devils, and hold of every foul spirit, and a cage of every unclean, hateful bird. And so it's Babylon that is the great problem, if you want to use that word, versus the one the scriptures use. Verse 3, for all the nations have fallen by have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. Who's her? Babylon. Still talking about Babylon. Look at verse 10. Standing afar off for the fear of her torment, saying, alas, alas, the great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour is thy judgment come. Look over in verse 21. And a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and cast it into the sea, saying, thus with violence shall that great city, Babylon, be thrown down and shall be found no more at all. And so again, I'm not here to argue that Rome is not the answer. I'm just giving you the information as to what would suggest it might not be. I'm not an expert on why it might be Rome. I've always, again, struggled with it because it was powerful. Don't get me wrong. But when you consider, I think it was actually in Sadler's commentary on Revelation, where he talks about, you know, when Alexander the Great finally stopped, the belief or the understanding is he wept because there were no more kingdoms to conquer, because he had conquered everything that he could come across. So that's the extent that Alexander the Great went. And so Rome, I mean, goodness, in the days even that Jesus was there, they were having trouble with all kinds of people, Gauls and everybody. And so who's to say if it's Rome, who's to say it's not? I don't know. But again, I think ultimately what Daniel is talking about there, that fourth one, is the Antichrist's kingdom domination. So. Yeah, I didn't even get into that for time's sake, but yeah, he does mention the ten horns as well.
And that's future.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying. It has to be a futuristic one. And so the answer for those who believe in Rome is that somehow Rome is going to... I'm struggling with the right word here because I don't want to put words in their mouth. I don't know if they're going to suggest that it's reformed, but if it's the power seat from Rome itself today, you know, those who suggest that the Pope is involved, or whatever the case may be, I think they would even agree that it's a futuristic, but somehow Rome is involved. So,
in Revelation 13, it only speaks of three and not four. So it speaks of the leopard, bear, and lion, and doesn't reference the four.
Well, in Daniel, he only references the three animals, too. He mentions four kings, but he still, if I remember right, I'll have to go back, they're already turned off. If you've got it in front of you, you can go ahead and read it again. There we go. Daniel 7.
Beast.
Yeah, the four great, verse 3, and four great beasts came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, the second like a bear, and the third was like a leopard. And then he saw the fourth, and he's different than the rest. It's not described as one of those types of animals. So...
That's
what
he's saying.
It's
the Antichrist.
Yeah, couldn't that lead to that it is the Antichrist?
I think so. Again, that's why I think the preponderance of the evidence, talking to an attorney here, I thought I'd use that phrase, to me would suggest that, yeah.
And it had 10 horns, and he says it there, too.
Yeah. But again, I don't want to... rip on the idea of the Rome thing, because I can't argue all of their aspects of why. They may be able to answer those questions, that part of it. I've never really, to be honest with you, I've never really seriously considered it Rome. I studied it to this extent before many years ago, and I was convinced, and so I never really gave it much second thought, I guess, on the idea of Rome.
Does 13 and 14 help explain it any better?
In Daniel?
Yeah, in chapter 7.
I'll go back there again. Good thing is it turned right up. All right, you said verses 13?
Mm-hmm.
I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven, and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion, glory, and a kingdom, and all the people, nations, and kingdoms should serve him. Yeah, I mean, this is obviously talking about Christ at the end. And so, Daniel, what is Daniel's theme that he's generally talking about? He's talking about the prophecy, considering the tribulation and stuff like that. So to me, yeah, it would make the most sense that we're talking about, one way or the other, the Antichrist's.
That's what I thought. It sounded like the Antichrist.
Yeah, kingdom going on here. So that's what it seems to me is going to be, is what's going to happen. And again, back at Revelation chapter 13, we'll finish up here. know, you have these seven kings, which are kingdoms that are described as mountains, and then if the idea that some is it will, I guess we'll talk about this next week, is that that the Antichrist is one of those seven. That seems to make the most sense. So. Right. And
again, huh? I was just reading. That's Babylon, isn't it?
Well, but that, I think that still fits. Yeah. I think that that fourth is going to be a kingdom. The Antichrist is going to have a kingdom. And I think that that associates it with Babylon, just like Revelation 18 describes Babylon as that great city that has to be destroyed. You know, Jerusalem is that great holy city. Babylon is the seat where it says all evil has flowed out of. From the very beginning, that's where the evil has entered into the world. Makes most sense that that's going to be, as the Bible describes, as going to be the seat of authority for the Antichrist. But then again, we don't know what we don't know. If you know history, whenever Alexander the Great, he conquered the world, he was from Macedonia, technically not even part of Greece in many ways, but eventually it is. But where does he set up his authority to?
Rome.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Babylon.
Babylon.
He fell in love with Babylon, and that's where he ended up living for a long time. So is it something similar to that? Again, that's I go back to the whole Rome thing. You know, is Rome somehow affected, but really the seat of authority is going to be in Babylon? Again, I don't know, but I personally, again, I think that that's talking about the Antichrist. And so, however that's going to work, again, we don't know what we don't know. You know, we know what we do, and we can speculate. So, some of the things we didn't talk about is when we talk about this Antichrist, and we'll talk about it, where does the Scripture seem to indicate that he comes out of? What do you recall about the Antichrist? What's his heritage? Is he a Jew or Gentile?
Oh, that's fine.
He's a Jew. Yes, it seems to indicate that he is going to come out of the Gentile nations, but he's going to have Jewish heritage, which only makes sense if you think about it. How is he going to imitate the Messiah if he's not Jewish? And so he's going to be trying to imitate Christ.
How will Israel accept him?
What's that?
How will Israel accept him if he's not Jewish?
Exactly, that's what I'm saying. And so, and we'll look at some of the other passages to talk about it, but yep, you're exactly right, Brandon, that it does seem like when you look at some of the different passages in Isaiah that suggest that he is going to come out of Syria, Turkey, or Iraq, or one of those three. I've usually been led to believe that it's going to be Turkey, but any of those are part of the old Assyrian kingdom. And that's what Scripture seems to indicate, is he's going to be coming out of that area. So.